Our reading this morning is from Romans chapter 8. It starts with the word therefore, so it's referring back to what Paul has already said in the previous seven chapters. Romans 8, verse 1. Therefore, there is now no condemnation for those who are in Christ Jesus, because through Christ Jesus, the law of the Spirit who gives life has set you free from the law of sin and death. For what the law was powerless to do because it was weakened by the flesh, God did by sending his own Son in the likeness of sinful flesh to be a sin offering. And so he condemned sin in the flesh in order that the righteous requirement of the law might be fully met in us who do not live according to the flesh but according to the Spirit. Those who live according to the flesh have their minds set on what the flesh desires. But those who live in accordance with the Spirit have their minds set on what the Spirit desires. The mind governed by the flesh is death, but the mind governed by the Spirit is life and peace. The mind governed by the flesh is hostile to God. It doesn't submit to God's law, nor can it do so. Those who are in the realm of the flesh cannot please God. You, however, are not in the realm of the flesh, but in the realm of the Spirit, if indeed the Spirit of God lives in you. And if anyone doesn't have the Spirit of Christ, they do not belong to Christ. But if Christ is in you, even though your body is subject to death because of sin, the Spirit gives life because of righteousness. And if the Spirit of him who raised Jesus from the dead is living in you, he who raised Christ from the dead will also give life to your mortal bodies because of his Spirit who lives in you. Therefore, brothers and sisters, we have an obligation, but it's not to the flesh to live according to it, but for if you live according to the flesh, you will die. But if by the Spirit you put to death the misdeeds of the body, you will live. For those who are led by the Spirit of God are the children of God. The Spirit you received doesn't make you slaves so that you live in fear again. Rather, the Spirit you received brought about your adoption to sonship. And by him we cry, Abba, Father. The Spirit himself testifies with our spirit that we are God's children. Now, if we are children, then we are heirs, heirs of God, co-heirs with Christ, if indeed we share in his sufferings, in order that we may also share in his glory.
Well, once again, good morning. Welcome to Grace Fellowship. It's great to have you here with us. We're going to be considering a passage in Colossians. So if you've got one of those blue pew Bibles from before, that's page 833. If you don't, you probably know where to find it yourselves, don't you? We've been in Colossians for a little while. You join us partway through a series. And context, we always want to have context when we come to a passage of Scripture. So let's consider the big picture context from Colossians as we get going. Church there in Colossae has faced false teachers coming in, teaching Christ plus teaching. They were saying, Christ, well, that's a great start, but that's the simple things. You need to move on. And there were all sorts of things which were Christ plus teaching coming in, trying to lead those saints astray. It's a good start, but... And Paul's answer all the way through has been, Christ is supreme. Everything he's done so far is to paint the picture of Christ as supreme, to give him the glory. There's been some amazing riches in what we've seen so far. Why does he do that? Because if Christ is supreme, Christ is sufficient. If Christ is supreme, to add anything is to detract from him, and therefore we cannot add anything. I went to Sunday school with a young lad whose stock answer was always Moses. Whatever the question, he would answer Moses. Colossians feels a bit like that. Whatever the error, whatever the thing that they were trying to put on top, the answer is Christ. Christ has done all of that. So we've always got that clue to the answer. And in Colossians, last time we were together in this 2 weeks ago, we saw Paul's goal for them. What did Paul want for this group of believers? And I think chapter 2, verses 6 and 7, which I've summarized there, just as you've received Christ as Lord, continue to live in him. You've been saved by grace, go on in grace. Go on to what? To a life of luxury and laziness? No, be strengthened in the faith. And when you're strengthened in that faith, what should it look like? Well, it's not a dusty old book faith. It's not a crusty professor of theology faith. It's a faith that's overflowing with thankfulness. A faith that's bursting with joy and therefore should almost be infectious. That's the faith that mature faith should become. Faith that stands the test. Faith that sees all of life's hardships come and still can thank the Lord. False teaching comes not out of nothing. False teaching comes, and I think we saw this earlier in the series, as a response to a real problem. And what was the real problem that these false teachers were trying to deal with, the ones that we're going to see today? They were trying to deal with the problem of how do we tame what we could call the lower appetites, the desire in our body to do things that are sinful, the desire in our bodies to do things that are sinful. Paul picks this up. Paul wrote this letter, he wrote lots of other letters in the New Testament. Picks this up when he says, we've got an old man in us, an old sinful nature that we need to deal with. And he uses very strong language when he deals with that. He says we need to put that to death, that old man, with its sinful desires. So taking that problem, what did these teachers do? Well, they came to the conclusion that actually it's my body that makes me sin. My spirit is perfect, but my body leads me into all this sin. In fact, all matter is evil. That was a starting premise. How do we respond to that? How do they carry on with that? Well, they said, we need to treat the body harshly. And here we've got a word which I'm nervous about pronouncing now. Asceticism. The ascetic principle. The ascetic principle is that we control the externals. We deny ourselves. So Lent, actually, giving stuff up for Lent, that would be an ascetic principle. Quite a minor end of the scale. It's around what we eat and bring into our body. So it links back to chapter 2, verses 16 and 17, the days and the diets. It also links into mysticism, which we saw in verses 18 and 19, because there was a process for some of these teachers of blending a pick and mix of religions into this faith that was more than just simple Christ. And before these people, the Hindus were sitting on beds of nails before this letter was written. And these ascetic practices of being harsh in treating the body were commonplace in Eastern religions. Obviously, they're commonplace all around the world. Asceticism, then, you didn't come to church this morning thinking about asceticism, I don't suppose. What is it all about? Actually, when we go through the passage, when we get to the passage, we will do that. There are some words there. False humility. Got the ESV, false humility, we translated asceticism. And also harsh treatment of the body, the way we treat the externals of the body. Here is the passage. So Colossians chapter 2, verses 20 to 23. Since you died with Christ to the elemental spiritual forces of this world, why, as though you still belong to the world, do you submit to its rules? Do not handle, do not taste, do not touch. These rules, which have to do with things that are all destined to perish with use, are based merely on human commands and teaching. Such regulations, indeed, have an appearance of wisdom. With their self-imposed worship, their false humility, and their harsh treatment of the body, but they lack any value in restraining sensual indulgence. So that word ascetic has a common Greek root with athletic. And Paul elsewhere talks about the fact that we do need to be masters of our body. Our bodies do, in the flesh, lead us towards sin. And we have to be masters of our body. And his famous quote, everyone who competes in the games goes into strict training. He beats his body. He makes his body his servant, as he's a servant of the gospel. That's good. But what these teachers were suggesting was something else. And there are lots and lots of pictures you can find of ascetic practices. So this could be a picture of Simeon Stylites. This guy, in order to draw closer to God and to elevate his spiritual life, lived for 37 years on top of a pillar. 37 years on top of a pillar. That wasn't enough suffering to get him close to God. He prostrated himself on that pillar 1,244 times a day. Every 69 seconds, he laid himself flat to get closer to God. No use, Paul says. Another process that was an early Christian is reducing our bodily intake of food to the absolute irreducible minimum. So here we go with a guy from an Eastern religion who starved himself almost to the point of death to elevate his spiritual life. Sitting on beds of nails as part of our process of getting closer to God and denying the body, treating it harshly. And if you are a particularly devout Catholic in Southern Ireland, you might decide a pilgrimage to the top of Crowpatrick would be the thing to get you closer to God. Every year this pilgrimage is taken. And the faithful, the really faithful, the ones who are the most spiritual, do it barefoot. That spiritual should have been in inverted commas. So this is what we're talking about, this whole approach. And I think we've seen, it's not confined to one brand of religion, is it? It's a worldwide thing that religions have added in or built themselves on. And that, I think, relates into our passage. So, start with verse 20 and look through. Since you died with Christ to the elemental spiritual forces of this world, why, as though you still belong to the world, do you submit to its rules? We've seen this elemental spiritual forces piece before. That could be translated as basic. These basic teachings. And Paul there is, if that's the translation, he's putting down these new teachers who are saying we're much more sophisticated. Sophisticated, you got nothing. Or it could be the elemental spiritual forces, the spiritual forces that are real in the world, the devil and the temptations that come from those forces that are real in the world, but they are not God. And we aren't subject to them anymore. Once we've become Christians, we are not subject to those forces. We have no reason to give in to the rules of those forces. We once may have, but we now don't. The story is told of Napoleon calling a man up to his army. He needed more people in his army, and he sent the call to this man in this village, and the man didn't respond. You don't not respond to Napoleon, do you? He had a Napoleon complex. He was quite keen on his power. So he sent more people to go and find out why this man hadn't responded to his duty to France. Turned out the man had died 10 years earlier. The man no longer had a duty to Napoleon. He had died as a French citizen, and he had that duty no more. We no longer have a duty to these other forces. Our duty is to Christ the King. Our duty is to Christ the King. We are dead to what we used to be subject to. And we are now alive to Christ. So we don't live by those rules. We don't live by the imposed rules of this world. Does that raise some... Well, we live by a different kingdom, by different rules. That raises a question, doesn't it? What about governments? Do we do what governments tell us? Or are you saying, Andrew, here we don't live by any rules? Well, we do. Romans 13 tells us that everyone must submit himself to the governing authorities. To the extent that they are not against the laws of Christ, we submit to the governing authorities. We should be model citizens as Christians, not lawless citizens. But we do live in a different kingdom and by different rules, by Christ's rules. And we can get concerned, how big is this list of rules and how much must I do to comply with this list of rules? Well, the list of rules is actually quite small. The compliance is quite difficult. But the list of rules Christ would give us is love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your mind. So our vertical relationship with God has got to be prime. It's got to be the thing that consumes us, as it were. Because that is our vertical relationship, where we have to have that duty of loving the Lord, our God, with all our heart, soul, and mind. and then love your neighbour as yourself. Keep those two commands. We don't have to think about a long list of rules. We don't have to think about beating our body and walking up a mountain with bare feet, sitting on a bed of nails and starving ourselves after death. Just keep those rules. There's a lot in those rules, though, isn't there? What does the passage go on to say? And here we get to the nub of the false teaching. These are the things that we're imposing. Do not handle, do not taste, do not touch. You see the progression. Handling is kind of got a long-term handling of something. Do not taste. We're obviously there about eating and about diets. Do not touch. Have nothing to do with this physical matter. Not even a glancing blow, a brush with this physical matter. Don't even touch. And whatever it was, they were putting these rules on us, on other people and on themselves. These rules which have to do with things that are all destined to perish with use. If you've got the Pew version of the NIV, that'll render that slightly differently. It doesn't render it very well. The rules are all about things that perish with use. So food. Food perishes with use, doesn't it? You eat food and it's not food anymore. It stops being food. It's a temporary thing. All the things in this world are temporary things. And they are based on human commands and teaching. The key here is that the externals are not eternal. And our spiritual life is about the eternals, not the externals. So let's not focus on all those rules about the things we do with food and about beating the body and so on. But we might, well, as we've seen, religions and prohibitions kind of go together, don't they? We see religion and people would characterize religion as the things you do not do, the things that you go without, all that list of no's. And Paul's saying, no, that's not what it's about. We might also say, actually, doesn't the Bible have lots and lots of stuff about what we do and don't eat? Well, the Old Testament did. But what did Jesus say about that? Mark chapter 7, verses 18 and 19. Don't you see that nothing that enters a person from the outside can defile them? For it doesn't go into the heart, but into the stomach and then out of the body. In saying this, Jesus declared, all food's clean. So now if you want to have a scallop wrapped in bacon on a barbecue, that's absolutely fine. In fact, nobody else can tell you from a spiritual perspective what you should and shouldn't eat. The fifth Mars bar might be a problem. But not from a spiritual perspective, except maybe your gluttony. But isn't this a common thing? Muslims refuse alcohol and pork. Jews, an Orthodox Jew, will have two kitchens, one for dairy, one for meat. Catholics will eat fish on a Friday, never meat on a Friday. All external things which perish with use. All human commands and traditions, because these things are God-given and God-given for us to enjoy. Christ has ended those sort of rules, those rules that pointed to our need for purity, our need for perfection. He's ended it by being our purity and by being our perfection. It says that they're based on human commands. So Christ has dealt with the Old Testament requirements. This is only left with human commands. And it defines for so many what religion is. I think the devil is tremendously happy with that, don't you? Devil must see this as quite a key strategy. Religion, that's all about what you can and can't have. So that puts half the world off religion, doesn't it? You're telling me it's all about these rules and stuff? I don't want any of that. So half the world is put off. The vast majority of the rest are just distracted from any approximation to God, any getting close to God, because all we're interested is in keeping a set of rules. And that was never what God wanted. It's a masterstroke for the devil to come up with this idea that we can have a rules-based religion and just deal with the externals and it'll get us close to God. Absolute genius. Human commands and teachings. Paul in verse 23 then gives us the deception of this practice of asceticism. Such regulations have an appearance of wisdom with their self-imposed worship. their false humility and their harsh treatment of the body, but they lack any value in restraining sensual indulgence. See, there is a need to restrain sensual indulgence. Paul's not saying that's wrong. But this approach of beating the body, of extreme treatment of the body, that ain't doing it. Why doesn't it do it? Well, because, as we've talked about already, it's this wisdom from below, from man's teaching, inspired from below, that distracts us from God. It's a self-imposed worship or a man-made religion, as some of the translations you've got on your laps might say. It's man-made and gets in the way of us getting to God. It is merely earthly, and it is unspiritual. Jesus spoke about this, didn't he? About those hypocrites who fasted. And when they fasted, they made their faces, or rubbed them with ash to make themselves look even more like they were fasting. And they went out into the streets. It was all for show. And that was a complete deception. It had the appearance of wisdom. But that appearance of wisdom is merely a trap set by the devil. It has the appearance of humility. But those hypocrites didn't really have humility, did they? They went out into the streets so that everybody could look at them and say what a fantastic job they were doing of being close to God by punishing their bodies. And Paul has it here, a false humility. We've seen before, false humility puffs us up. So actually, the externals are all about people seeing those externals. And then Paul says, in terms of restraining sensual indulgence, it has no value. It has no value. The purpose it's set out to achieve, it doesn't even achieve. Firstly, because pride is a sin. And if we're doing all these things to look good, well, we've fallen into the sin of pride. So we're already there. The guy at the top of the pillar, everybody looked up to him, didn't they? He was pretty proud about that, perhaps. Those hypocrites were proud. There was a group of Pharisees who were known as the bleeding Pharisees, because whenever they saw somebody, and maybe there was a pretty young girl, they would put their head down to avoid their eyes being distracted, and they'd walk into things and bump themselves to the point of bleeding. That was a mark of their holiness, and they wore it with pride. Another one, actually, St. Bernard. Apparently this monk habitually covered his eyes to avoid seeing the beauty of the Swiss lakes when he passed. God made the Swiss lakes. Look at them and rejoice in them. Don't avoid them. But this pride that comes from it is an issue. Also, the effectiveness in restraining sin. It has no value. If we think about that, a celibate priesthood. How is that working out in terms of restraining sexual sin? I've got a feeling it's not the best solution. But also, there is in the human heart this desire to overcome the rules. One person said, the tighter the weave, the more the holes. And where there are holes in the rules, people will find a way through those holes. A man called Hans Kung decided that he was going to follow the 2,414 rules in the Roman Code of Canon Law. 2,414 rules to make him right with God. What did he say about that? He said all his energy was gone either in keeping the rules or getting round the rules. He spent the whole day either checking off that he'd done the right thing or finding a way to get through the net and do the thing that he really wanted to do. What happened as a consequence? All his energy was gone with this set of 2,414 rules, and no energy was left for the work of the gospel. An externally imposed set of rules is never what Christ demanded. And if other people seek to impose them on us, they've no right to do that. No right to impose that external set of rules upon us. Christ has told us, absolutely. Christ has told us, love the Lord your God with all your heart, all your soul, all your mind. Love your neighbour as yourself. Keep those rules. But other rules imposed on us, we have no reason to be subject to those rules. What right has somebody else to put those rules on another man's servant? We are Christ's servant. Actually, that verse wasn't written that way, was it? Romans 14. What right have you to judge another man's servant, another servant? So we have no right to put our rules on anybody else. We have no right to say, actually, you, brother, you're not much of a Christian, because when we had that prayer vigil the other week, I took the 3 o'clock to 4 o'clock in the morning shift while you were lying in bed. We can't impose those rules on somebody else, because that's another man's servant. That's God's servant. Doesn't answer to us. Doesn't answer to us. So these things have got no effect, are of no value. We live in a different kingdom with a different set of rules. We are concerned with the eternal. We should be concerned with the eternal, not the external. And we shouldn't fall into the deception of asceticism that it brings us closer to God. What is it we should be looking at? We should be looking at the wonder of grace. See, we don't have these rules to get closer to God. We have grace to get closer to God. Grace that says God has come and found us. And the wonder of grace is found in these two lines. And actually, I've been a Christian for two-thirds of the year. I've tried to do it all year. But since I was 14, it's a long time ago now. But I don't think I've got a full grasp of grace. I can give you a definition of grace. I can tell you passages about grace from the scripture. I believe fundamentally in grace as the thing that saves us. But I don't think deep in my heart I've really settled on grace. Martin Lloyd-Jones, who's probably the best preacher this country's produced in hundreds of years, said if you don't preach the gospel in a way that people misunderstand, you haven't preached it right, in all likelihood. Because the gospel is shocking. There is a hint of scandal with this gospel that we have. Because here I stand as one who's loved by God, one that Christ has died for, and these two lines are true. There is nothing I can do to make God love me more. So I can't sit on the top of a tower for 37 years. I can't flagellate every time that my lust gets a control of me and get closer to God. It doesn't do it. And there's nothing I can do to make him love me less. So I can fall into areas of sin, and it won't stop God loving me. In fact, I've got a visual illustration here. That's a pool ball. I didn't just bring it to stop people playing. But that's a pool ball. That looks really smooth, doesn't it? Statistically, apparently, the bumps and crevices on the surface of that pool ball are higher and lower than the bumps and crevices on the earth. The imperfections there are higher than Mount Everest. Doesn't look like it to us, does it? What does that mean? That means we cannot climb our way to God's approval. We can't climb our way, barefoot or otherwise, to God's approval. But praise be to God. He loves us because he loves us. He loves us because he reached down to love us. And there's nothing we can do to make him love us more, and there's nothing we can do to make him love us less. Now, that is really scary. That is absolutely fantastic for me. I love the fact that God looks at me like that. I don't really like the fact that he looks at you like that, because you'll get up to all sorts of mischief. And I really don't want you getting up to all sorts of mischief. I would quite like to set some rules for you and me have that freedom. That is the problem with grace. Well, there comes a problem with grace. W.H. Auden put it this way. Every crook will argue, I like committing crimes. God likes forgiving crimes. Really, the world is most admirably arranged. What a fantastic thing. We're sinners. God loves sinners. Brilliant. I'll get on doing some sinning. What did Paul say? Apostle Paul said, what shall we say then? Shall we go on sinning so that grace may increase? By no means. Forbid it, God, it says elsewhere. We are those who have died to sin. How can we live in it any longer? We have died to sin. Like that man who didn't need to answer Napoleon's call to serve in the army. We don't need to answer the devil's temptation to sin. We don't need to answer our flesh's temptation to sin. And our flesh's temptation just isn't. that extreme sexual temptation that comes to us when we're younger men and dissipates somewhat when we become older and energies reduce. But it's the pride, it's the selfishness, it's the meanness with our money, it's the despising of other people, it's the puffing ourselves up. All of those things are the sins of the flesh that we do need to deal with. We're not going to deal with all those this morning, because as we go through this series, and I've looked ahead a little bit, we will start to deal with those. Because whilst grace says you are freed from human regulations, we're not freed from God's law. In fact, if you look at if you've got the NIV in front of you, the start of this teaching block in verse 6 of chapter 2 says freedom from human regulations. So nobody's going to impose human regulations on us that Christ doesn't give us. But then the start of chapter 3 says rules for holy living. And Mike's going to start preaching on that in a couple of weeks' time, so I won't steal what he has in front of him. But this principle, we are dead to those old temptations. Oh, they're still there. Of course they're still there. But we don't have to be subject to their power. So what do we need then? We need not an outside-in imposed restriction on our sin and conquering of our sins. It's not that harsh treatment of the body. It's an inside-out change. Jesus said that in Mark chapter 7, verse 20-23. Just after he declared that all food was clean, he went on to say, it's what comes out of a person that defiles them. For it is from within, out of a person's heart, that evil thoughts come. Sexual immorality, theft, murder, adultery, greed, malice, deceit, lewdness, envy, slander, arrogance and folly. There's plenty for us to deal with, but it's to be dealt with inside out. Proverbs chapter 4, and the verses on the floor there, and I'm not bending down just now. Guard your heart, for out of it flow the issues of life. We have to guard our heart. How are we going to guard our heart? How are we going to guard our heart? We're going to guard our heart because we're freed from the power of the old life, because we've been buried with Christ in baptism. We're alive with him now. But we're going to do it by our appetites, not by the externals, not by effort, but by love. By love. I read one quote, that nature determines appetites. Nature determines appetites. So if you've got a lion as a pet, and you decide the lion's looking a little bit chubby, I know what, rocket salad and quinoa. That would do the lion the world of good. That's the kind of diet he needs to get in trim. It's not going to work, is it? A lion eats meat. If you get in that plate, I think you'd be the snack rather than the quinoa. Nature determines appetite. We are dead to that old nature. And we are united with Christ, baptized with him and alive with him. And it's that uniting with Christ, being alive in him, that's the thing that's going to put to death the sins of the flesh. Not standing on a towel for 37 years, not sitting on a bed of nails, not eating fish on a Friday, not remaining celibate when we haven't been told we have to, because we can marry, we're free to marry. It's not the externals, it's not effort, but it's love. You know what? I want it to be effort, because I want to bring something. That's the way it is. We're going to sing the song, Amazing Grace, How Sweet the Sound That Saved a Wretch Like Me. It says, how sweet that grace appeared the day I first believed, the hour I first believed. And it did. But I think for us, we want to go and put something on to it. We want to bring our own effort. Christian life isn't easy. I'm not saying it's a life with no effort. But our standing before God and the extent to which he loves us isn't about our effort. But what he wants is for us to love him in return. And we'll end with the words from Augustine of Hippo. And these words, I think, are astonishing. And they pick up what we've seen before. If you but love God, you may do as you incline. Think of that. if you love God, you can do anything you like. If you but love God, I don't think you're going to want to be selfish anymore, because we want to be like God, and he's put that appetite in our hearts. In fact, if we love God, we've got to love other people rather than despise other people and dislike other people. We've got to want the best for them because God wanted the best for them. And if we love God, we want to be like God and share love the way God shared love. And how did he share his love? He didn't crush us out like a bug. He came with open arms to save us. If we but love God, we can do whatever we're inclined to do. If we but love God, the inclinations of our heart, the appetites of our lives, I believe will be radically changed. If we but love God, we can do whatever we're inclined. What's your asceticism? What's mine? What's that thing that we do? Perhaps this morning's your asceticism. I can tick the box. I went through the pain of going to church and listening to a sermon. We can tick the box. I put my money in the offering. If we love God, we can do as we incline. Does that mean we don't put the money in the offering? It might mean we put more in, because all of it is on the altar. Does that mean I don't have to go to home group when it's a wet Wednesday? Well, actually, it might mean that I must go to the home group, because where else will I hear about God's goodness? Where else will I have the chance to express my love for those people that God has loved? We can do whatever we incline.